this is a forum to have conversation about the lessons of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It being August 10th, the day after the second anniversary of Nagasaki, it may be that we're doing a typically American thing, been there, done that, got the t-shirt, what do you want to talk about? Or we may have had such a great conversation last week that people are satisfied. But whatever is at work to create such a sweet number of us together tonight, we will have conversation. My name is Martin Wells. I'm one of the directors of the Village, and I'll be the moderator for tonight's conversation. We've asked an inexhaustive panel of persons who might speak to this issue. Nevertheless, they are the persons we have asked, and we expect to have a good conversation with them. Absent, this is either a veteran or a veteran spouse, or perhaps this is Harry Truman himself, who left the Village yesterday, from our panel. Either one of those persons, or any of those three, spoke powerfully during the course of the week. And those of you who may be veterans or veteran spouses are encouraged to speak tonight. And if any of you can channel Harry Truman, that would be wonderful. In the Northwest, we're used to that sort of New Age phenomena, and so we'd be happy to have him with us. Otherwise, we have Mark Moeller, who teaches systematics at our seminary in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. Oh, what did I say? Gettysburg?
The state was right.
The state was right.
The town was
Philadelphia. There we go. Thank you. You know, I never lived in the East, and that's the problem.
There's a slight difference between the two.
Mark is in the United States as of 4 years ago to teach at our seminary, and before that lived in Germany, and we've asked him to be here tonight to say something about the remembrances and the perceptions of things from a European and what he knows of an American point of view. We will leave it at that and let him explore that and take it where he wants to go with it. Walt Bowman is here as our program director. Walt teaches systematic theology at our seminary in Columbus, Ohio, and will speak briefly tonight on the Just War tradition. As much as anything, and we admitted this when we asked Walt to participate, because that part of the Augsburg Confession needs to be raised before us regularly, or we simply forget that we are people of that tradition. And whatever it may have to do with the remembrances from 50 years ago will be welcome fodder for conversation tonight. Rick Dunning is here. Rick is a geologist and curator of our museum. And I've asked Rick to be here tonight, hoping that he had an opportunity to review the movie The Day After Trinity, because it's been my opinion, and since I'm the moderator, I get to exercise my opinions in some ways, that the whole notion of scientific pressure may have had something to do with why we used those weapons when we did, and may have something to contribute in the present day, as we see other huge scientific endeavors moving along, rather unknown to public conversation. And so we've asked him to speak to the notion of science has known sin, a quotation ostensibly from Robert Oppenheimer, the head of the project that developed those first bombs. And Tim Gamlin is a political scientist and a pastor, and has offered to go last in our panel and be something of a a reflector on what other people say, and a person who gathers together some comments and has some original offerings of his own then, of course, as well. We advertised, as we did last week, for a veteran and a spouse who could bring to us a very personal view of those days. Either one is not available, or we didn't advertise well enough, or I got to coffee break too late to meet them, or something happened, but we didn't have anyone offer to be here this evening. And there are a variety of other persons, obviously, who could speak to this topic, and perhaps some of you will represent those viewpoints and will want to come up and even assume the chair for a while as a presenter from some area of special knowledge you have. But otherwise, we're simply a circle of conversation, and it's a wonderfully open room tonight. We're going to give these folks up here 6 or 7, no more than 8 minutes, to say what they would like to say to begin, and then we'll open the conversation. Questions are welcome if one of these folks is terribly obtuse and you simply don't get what they're saying. Go ahead and raise your hand, and that will be a signal, since I know they're all conversational and would welcome an opportunity to clarify the point they're trying to make. We'll end the evening wondering whether, and asking you whether, anything new might have been learned tonight, something that might have come to you as new in the conversation. So let's begin. And we really began with Scott Brundage 2 nights ago. I hope many of you had an opportunity to hear him. He was very powerful, very forceful. I don't know enough about Harry Truman to know whether that was a good representation of his persona and his thinking, but he certainly was well prepared to address many of the questions that have been burning in our minds, my mind and others, about, for instance, why we didn't use a demonstration bomb, and why didn't we worry about the civilians and those issues. So his presence, I think, is palpable here for those of us who did hear him. Otherwise, I'd like to begin with Walt and just ask Walt to give us a few minutes of a brief exposition of the just war theory. And if you want to know more, there's wonderful tapes in the library, particularly from Mennonite scholar John Howard Yoder, who has taught many of us Lutherans about our own tradition and the just war theory. But Walt is our speaker now.
Thank you. I just want to read the relevant paragraph in the Augsburg Confession of 1530. So it's 465 years old. Our churches teach, Article 16, that lawful civil ordinances are good works of God, and that it is right for Christians to hold civil office, sit as judges, decide matters by the imperial and other existing laws, award just punishments, engage in just wars, serve as soldiers, make legal contracts, hold property, swear oaths when required by magistrates, marry, and be given in marriage. All of that in one paragraph. But the key phrase here is engage in just wars. All of the traditions that come out of the 16th century, Presbyterian, Anglican, Lutheran, and Roman Catholic, hold officially to the doctrine that justifiable war is something in which Christians may engage. The question, of course, is what constitutes justifiable war? In our library here at Holden, John Howard Yoder raises that question in a book, When War is Unjust, and in it he tries to examine the validity of the just war doctrine. I just want to say briefly what the concept of a just war is, and then make some comments on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The just war doctrine is divided into two parts. The first are what conditions are required before war is declared. And these are the principal ones. All peaceful resolution must have been exhausted. In other words, the war is truly a last resort. Secondly, the cause itself must be just. Third, the goal must be limited, that is, restoration of the status quo ante before the occasion for the war begins. Fourth, our motive must not be hatred or revenge. Fifth, success must be probable. You cannot fight justifiably if it's quite clear you're going to lose from the beginning. And sixth, the authority that declares the war or wages the war must be legitimate. One of the great issues in the controversy over Vietnam and our involvement there was whether or not we were legitimately involved in the military action there. And President Johnson used the Tonkin Gulf resolution as his justification. But subsequent to that war, Congress clarified its position because the Constitution vests the power of declaring war in this country in the Congress. And so there is a limitation on the president's war-making powers. That would be an application of just war doctrine. In the war itself, the means must be indispensable to the solution of the, or to the prosecution of the war. The means used must be discriminate. That is, they should do no more harm than the harm they are trying to prevent. And they are not to be used against the civilian population. That's been standard in just war doctrine as long as it's been around. And finally, the means must respect international law, which means, for example, that prisoners are to be treated in a certain way, and they are to be respected as prisoners of war. They're not to be simply shot summarily and so on. Now, there are, I think, several problems that Yoder raises. One is that he knows of no instance where, let's say in this country at least, Lutherans have ever invoked the question of just war, nor for that matter have Anglicans or Presbyterians or Roman Catholics. Mainly, the prosecution of war depends upon political factors, upon the willingness largely of the populace to engage in the war. It's now quite significant that President Bush employed a public relations firm to sell the Americans on the justice of the Gulf War, the Desert War against Iraq, which indicates that we really don't trust the larger political processes. We want to, I suppose if one is a president, one wants to manipulate those processes, and that's exactly what President Bush did. There are two things I think that we can do with regard to the just war doctrine, and one of them is to try to learn from experiences like the Second World War, whether or not one can apply the criteria to that war. And it seems to me that they apply better to the German side of the war, that is to the hostilities against Germany, than they do to the Japanese. We did not, in fact, in the Second World War, distinguish between the two. I think that's one of the things that has to be said about that war. The second thing that has to be said is that we were probably not directly involved in the causes of the Second World War in Europe. And so the question as to whether or not all peaceful solutions had been exhausted is a moot point. It's now clear, as one looks back over the documents, Hitler was not interested in peaceful solutions. He wanted armed conflict when he was ready and at a point where he thought German arms could be tested, German superiority could be demonstrated. So in one sense, there really was no possibility of peaceful resolution there. With regard to Japan, as one looks at the diplomatic history of the United States and Japan from, let's say, 1930 to 1945, it is extraordinarily tragic that all peaceful means were not exhausted. There was a very sizable peace party in Japan headed by the government of Prince Konoye, and attempts were made to interpret that party to the United States government. They failed for some very peculiar reasons. We broke the Japanese code relatively early, and we're getting two sets of Japanese messages, one those beamed to the peace envoys in Washington, the other the military preparations which had to be made, said the Japanese, if in fact the peace process broke down. The question is which of the two to believe, you see. And in the State Department, more weight was placed on the interpretation by the China branch of the State Department than Ambassador Gru, whose cables were coming from Japan. And therefore, the reality seemed to be that the peace party was the real policy. The war policy was a contingency, a fallback position. But in Washington, the interpretation was the reverse. We said, the war preparations are the ones to be taken most seriously. The peace is the sham, the cover. And that's in fact what we believed, although subsequent diplomatic information seems to give us another story. At the end of the war, again, one of the things that happened in the First World War already is that there was a deliberate attempt to make war on civilian populations. And that was accelerated in the Second World War, although as I was just reading in the volume, The Arms of Krupp, the heavy bombing of Essen, which took place in the Second World War, and which was directed at not only the war-making potential, but the civilian population, failed. And now we know universally that bombing as a strategy, making war on the civilian population, only strengthens resistance. It does not end the war. What we did in Japan was fail, I think, to differentiate or to use these criteria to say we will settle for a negotiated peace, and then we would, Japan would have accepted that, we would not have had to drop the bombs, and in the end, again, we misread, I think, the information that Japan was giving us and needn't have dropped the atomic weapons that we used in August of 1945.
Thank you. Michael.
I was asked to comment on the events 50 years ago in Japan from a European perspective, and I also would like to add a particularly German perspective, because I think that is also different. What I observe as a European comparing attitudes toward war in the US and in Europe is that it seems that the experience of war on the territory of Europe has left much deeper scars on the emotion of people. And therefore, when people debate war and peace issues in Europe, these debates are much more emotional than this kind of cool, objective, laid-back debate of whether the war was shortened or not shortened by the dropping of this or that bomb. I was born 11 years after the war had ended, but I still remember very clearly war-damaged buildings in my neighborhood, the fear of people that maybe the war might begin again. I remember as a little boy, we were living near a military area where jets were flying a lot, and I, as a kid, was afraid of war in a very substantial way. I think also there's a difference because the fate of civilians in wars was never really experienced in the U.S. context as it was in the European context. I think even in the Civil War, there was not much harm done to civilians. So there was actually maybe from the very beginning of this nation on never a war that really caused mass amounts of civilians to die. And that, of course, was quite different in Europe, where war was close to home. Here, war was always something, or most of the time, something that happened at a distant and faraway place. I think that, therefore, Americans tend to measure wars rather by their cause. What is the objective of the war? Why do we fight this war? And not so much look at the means that are taken in wars, because they don't experience the means firsthand. And I think that that was one of the great shocks of the Vietnam War, that for the first time people began to realize that no matter how noble your cause might be, atrocities and killings and all these things happen on both sides of the conflict, most present in the movie Casualties of War. By the way, the only movie that I know where the main hero of the film was a Lutheran. I don't know if you're aware of that. Michael J. Fox, in this one scene, speaks to a chaplain, and to a Methodist chaplain, and he says, "Well, I'm Lutheran." Actually, the first time that I had heard the word Lutheran in a major Hollywood movie. So that I think creates a very different perspective, particularly in the question of civilians. For Europeans, that is a question of having lost family members that were not active participants in the war. But then the second point that I would like to make is as a perspective from a nation that has lost the war and that has caused the war. I think that gives also a very different perspective on the events of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Germany certainly would have been the first and the prime target for the bomb, and it was mere by an accident of history that the bomb was not ready in time to be dropped on Germany because the war in Europe was over. If the bomb would have been constructed a couple of months before, I'm very certain that Germany would have been a target for the dropping of the bomb. I think that that the firebombing of Dresden, for example, shows that the military planners in the Second World War were willing to consider and execute military meaningless options to make their point. And that, I think, is a question that we have to ask. Is that morally justifiable to do that, no matter what noble point you are trying to make? Don't you rather damage the nobility of your cause by making your point in a way that is so destructive, particularly against civilians? On the other hand, I'm of course aware that Germany and Japan were both working on similar weapons, and that they would not have been hesitant at all to use it. Indeed, in Germany there was this great expectation that the miracle weapon would be found even days before the war ended and the turn of events would change. It is clear to me that Germany and Japan have committed atrocities in the war that seem to almost justify the most drastic means to stop their activities. But I think we have a parallel here to the discussion maybe some of you participated in regard to the death penalty. I don't necessarily argue against the death penalty because I think that the person who is convicted of a crime does not deserve to be punished. But I would rather argue against the death penalty and would similarly argue against the firebombing or the nuclear bombing of civilian population because it is not worth of the person who is doing it. And once you decide to do that, you jeopardize your own morality. I do not think that the end justifies the means, but rather that means contribute to make an end justifiable or not justifiable. And if you choose questionable means, you jeopardize the justice of the cause that you are fighting for. I personally do not think that that the dropping of the nuclear bomb in Hiroshima and Nagasaki is that much different from other means taken in the war. And therefore, I would not regard that as as some people say, the beginning of the nuclear age, and therefore a dramatic change in the history of warfare. It's certainly a new technology that was used in the war. If you want to talk about whether it is justifiable to use this kind of technology, I think we would have to ask the question, did the dropping of the bomb accomplish something that would not have been accomplished without it? And what was it? Was the war shortened, for example? I know that there's a big debate about that. Some people believe it was shortened, some people think it was not. It was not shortened. Did the horror of the bomb prevent further use of nuclear weapons? I think that people can make an argument for it, that no nuclear war broke out during the Cold War period might have to do with the experience of the horror of the nuclear destruction that happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Was a lesser amount of casualty needed to accomplish the objectives of the war? All these kinds of questions need to be asked, but make it not easier than to make a decision whether the dropping of the bomb was justifiable or not. Some people would argue also that there is something intrinsically evil in the dropping of the bomb, no matter what objective would be reached by it. I personally do not share that view, but I would say that the evil is beyond the singular act of dropping the bomb. The evil would be the decision to fight a war against civilians rather than against military objects, and that decision was made on both sides. It was not only made on the American side, but it was made on the Japanese and the German side. And therefore, I do not agree with people who think that that the Americans, by dropping the nuclear weapons, qualify for a more evil status in warfare over and against the Germans or the Japanese.
Thank you. Rick?
Well, I never set out to be a scientist when I started my post-high school education, but found out by the time that I finished all those years of school that I was one. And I knew also that fit me and my way of looking at the world, that somehow in the wrestling of perspectives that I did through school, that when I came to science, I came to one that for me was right. And I suppose ultimately it's a sense of curiosity. It's a more formalized way of satisfying that sense of curiosity, but it's questions like, how does that work, and how did that happen, and what happens if you do this? And in the asking of those questions, particularly in a careful way that a scientist would go about that, there's tremendous excitement. I felt that in my own work and in my interpretation of other people's works, my reading of other people's work. That's really a marvelous thing to be involved in. And I never apologize for being a scientist, and I know that that's kind of my mindset. And it was interesting to watch the Trinity video and to see the unfolding of that curiosity in a very specific way, toward a very specific end, in a peculiarly rarefied combination of minds that came together in Los Alamos. And I can begin to imagine what that atmosphere was like for the people that worked there, and the supercharged intellectual atmosphere, the questions asked, and the late night wrestling with the ideas. That's a tremendously exhilarating thing to be part of. But with the questions of science, there's always more questions. Well, if this is true, what now? And if that's true, then can we do this with it? Those questions don't ever end. And at some point, somebody has to be able to ask the questions about, well, if you do that, what's going to happen? And I'm not sure scientists are as carefully prepared to look at that side of their work as they are the digging part of their work. And I know that a lot of science is monotonous. Careful work in the lab, the hours of testing, the measurements, the statistical analyses, but also there's the exhilaration that drives the process. And what I saw in the video was that committed group of people working very hard to the same objective and wanting to know the answer, wanting to know how it would work. But it seemed like when they got to that test at Trinity, that first detonation, then they knew it would work. What went on beyond that is less clear to me, whether it was scientifically driven, commercially driven, militarily driven, ideologically driven, who took that technology and did with it what happened is less clear to me historically. But when we start to think about what lessons come out of this, I see the same sort of quandaries in other scientific endeavors. We are in a highly technological society where so many aspects of our lives benefit from the application of scientific discovery. And virtually all of those technologies have some side effects that aren't so good, and often unanticipated in their origins and the origins of the ideas. So that when we look at electricity and all the things that has brought to our lives, in the generation that electricity, we run into pollution problems and environmental destruction problems, and the mining of coal and the damming of rivers and the undermining of ecosystems. We're just beginning to have to wrestle with, is this miracle of electricity, at what cost has it come to us? Or the internal combustion engine, which is so revolutionized life in Western society or the technologies with which we produce our food and prevent it from being eaten by insects or harmed by noxious weeds. In each case, we've struggled to find ways to deal with, overcome difficulties, but in each case, there's some dangerous side effects. And who and how do we ask the harder questions? Not can we do this, but should we do this? Where within the society is the mechanism for that moral consideration of the scientific progress? And it hasn't been within the scientific community. And there's been a tendency to not take on the scientific community from the outside, so there hasn't been an outside force looking over the shoulder of the scientific community. But I think as a community of people, we need to struggle with that issue. The one thing I was most struck by in watching the video were the parallels to this place in the 40s and 50s. A group of young engineers and geologists looking at a mountain with a massive ore in it. Can we get that out? How can we get that out? And the rarefied, intense atmosphere that existed here in their efforts to get that out. And now 50 years later, what problems are we wrestling with that came out of that? Mm-hmm. But that's some of my reaction, at least.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Tim?
I was asked to be a part of this because I'm a two-career person. My first career was in political science, as I got a PhD in political science and spent 10 years teaching in international politics before being called to prepare for ordained ministry, and I'm now a parish pastor, so I bring some of the perspectives of two disciplines that are related to the issue at hand here. As I reflect on the issue and the presentations, it seems to me that a concept from political science that's very relevant to what came out of the dropping of these bonds is the concept of the threshold. You have heard from time to time the concept of the nuclear threshold, that there was something different about nuclear weapons from other kinds of weapons. I think this concept of the threshold links up to what I see and read in ethical Christian ethics writings, or ethics writings generally. From what I read, I gather there are two major bases on which people make ethical decisions. One is called deontological. That is, you make decisions based on duty. I make this decision because it is right to do so regardless of the consequences. So I decide that I will always tell the truth regardless what the consequences are of my telling the truth. The other perspective is identified as utilitarian. Whatever I decide to do, the main basis for my decision will be the consequences that will flow from the decision that I decide to make. So I need to measure what I decide in terms of what will flow from those consequences. My mother grew up in China, and at one time remembers an incident in which she was captive together with her father by communists who were driving the Americans out of China. She says, the only time I remember my father ever lying is when that group asked him how old I was. And he gave my age as significantly lower than I actually was because he was fearful that if he told the truth, they would rape me. So here was a person who would generally use the deontological basis for making ethical decisions, tell the truth, regardless of the consequences, but found the case where he became the utilitarian. I will tell a lie because the consequences of telling the lie are such that I will prefer that to telling the truth. In discourse in these days about abortion, the threshold becomes very important. When do you decide to make a decision based on the consequences and when or rather should we make the decision simply based on whether it's right or wrong? Some would say abortion's wrong, period. It's just wrong. Others will say, well, it depends on the situation. It depends on the consequences that would flow. The threshold then often becomes the place that divides where I'm willing to make decisions on the basis of utilitarian criteria, what will flow, and where I am unwilling to admit utilitarian criteria. At what point do I say, well, I simply decide this is right, this is wrong, and I will behave or decide in that manner regardless? In the matter of abortion, there are very few people who would argue for infanticide. Some do because they see the logic of the argument of abortion can lead to the very same arguments in favor of infanticide. But birth seems to be kind of a threshold. If a child is naturally born, there's a threshold there, so that very few people would cross that threshold and argue for killing an infant. If you move inside of that threshold, it's very difficult to find another threshold until you get to conception. And therein lies the problem. What criteria do you decide beyond which you're unwilling to go? A criterion that will give you a threshold where you no longer will use utilitarian criteria, but instead you use the deontological, duty-driven criterion for whether you will or will not abort. Nuclear weapons. One of the things that came out of the dropping of those two nuclear weapons was that many considered nuclear weapons to be a threshold. Some would say that the firebombing of Dresden, the firebombing of Tokyo, of Japanese cities, did as much destruction as those weapons did. Nonetheless, you see, nuclear weaponry provided a threshold beyond which many people were unwilling to go ethically. I will make the decision based on utilitarian criteria until I get to nuclear weapons, and then I'm absolutely against it. That became a point of debate. Some of you may remember that in 1968, Barry Goldwater campaigned for the presidency, and during the campaign indicated that he would be willing to use tactical nuclear weapons in Vietnam. The difficulty with that argument, even though tactical nuclear weapons would do no more destruction than many other kinds of weapons, very small nuclear weapons, the difficulty was crossing the threshold. Once you cross the threshold, where do you stop? Where do you draw the line where you say, I will go no farther? The nuclear threshold has become a very important part of the scene. And many would argue that that's a threshold that we dare not cross, because beyond it, we are on a slippery slope. There's no place to stop. The closest that we came to crossing it, as far as we know, historically, is in the Cuban Missile Crisis. And in that crisis, you may have seen some of the interviews now that are available of the Soviet officials that were working on the other side, as Kennedy and the cabinet were working on the American side. And it's very scary to learn that if the Americans apparently had done the surgical bombing of the Cuban missile sites, the Soviets were ready to begin nuclear warfare. From the interviews that I'm hearing, that seems to be the case. Willingness to cross that nuclear threshold, then what? So, when we come to thresholds in this matter, some would say that the threshold is killing. Gary Coles, I think, has been arguing that quite passionately. You simply refuse to kill under any circumstances. This suggests all sorts of moral dilemmas. The Jewish mother, who in hiding with several other Jews from Germans who are looking for them, Nazis who are looking for them, has a child in hand that begins to cry. The woman has to decide whether to stifle the child, even by killing the child, or to let the child cry, reveal the location of the people who are in hiding, and put all of them, as well as those who have been hiding them, at risk. Do you give? Is there a threshold there that you refuse to cross, even under the most excruciating circumstances? The just war theory really is an attempt to provide criteria that you refuse to cross. To say along that slippery slope, okay, we permit killing, we permit warfare, but what point are we unwilling to cross? And so we have several criteria that relate to the causes of war, and other criteria that relate to the means by which warfare can be conducted. And the just war theory attempts then to delineate these criteria and provide deontological criteria. We refuse to conduct war in these circumstances on the one side, and on the other side, utilitarian criteria. In warfare, we will measure what we do by the consequences of actions on the other side of those criteria. And whether the means or the causes of warfare become more important, these deontological versus utilitarian criteria are very important in that circumstance. Maybe I've used the 7 minutes, but I think that concept of the threshold becomes a very important outcome of the dropping of those two bombs and is extremely important in terms of where we have gone since then. It really is truly remarkable that we have gone 50 years without detonating another nuclear weapon in warfare. Kennedy said after the Cuban Missile Crisis, he was asked, what were the chances of going to war in the circumstances? He said, well, there was somewhere between 1 out of 2 and 1 out of 3. And if you extrapolate that, if you say we have a similar crisis once a decade, and you have 1 chance in 2 in the decade of the 60s, and 1 chance in 2 in the decade of the 70s, and 1 chance in 2 in the decade of the 30s, of the 80s, and keep going, the chances of surviving are very, very small, unless that nuclear threshold and the deontological perspective that we simply refuse to cross that threshold becomes very, very poignant in the thinking about these weapons.
Well, thank you all for contributing thus far. Now, we're interested in any comments or reflections that you may have. You may direct questions to panelists, or you may direct questions to the group as a whole, or muse out loud, or make a speech, or anything you want. What would you like to say? What have you brought to this conversation?
Not good or not bad.
Susan. I speak. I'll try to be short, and I don't know that I have a point to make. I'm struck, Michael, by your true statement that since the Civil War, you know, no war has been fought in this country, and that I was born in 1952. And have never lived in a place where the ravages of war were visibly present to me day by day. War was, in fact, what we sent. I mean, a child of the Vietnam War, that's the place my classmates died, that's the place we waited for my brother's draft number. But it was this sense that the worst would be we would send one we loved away and may not receive him back. And at that point, women were safe, frankly. We were not sent to war. We were not drafted in any way. But it was something that happened away from us, the results of which we would receive brokenheartedly, perhaps, but we wouldn't see what happened. But we live, nevertheless, under this threat of the bomb. I grew up in a highly militarized area, which we were told was a prime target for bombing. And we all had bomb shelters in our basements, stored food, stored water, the service book and hymnal, Bible, Dinty Moore stew, can opener, matches. I remember going down as a child and looking at the provisions set aside for the day of bombing. And we would have routine bomb drills in our classrooms. Going under the desks and waiting. So there was a sense that I had many nightmares about bombs. And we just mentioned this in our house the other day. Still, in my 40s, I want food. I should have been a Mormon. I want food and water stored in my basement. You know, what kind of a defense is that? It's no defense. But it's interesting that there, I think I bear scars of war, even though I've never lived, I bear the scars of the threat of war. Hearing sirens at night and waking up and thinking, this is it, Fort Lewis, McCord, Boeing, it's all going up. I mean, we were kind of a ground zero where I grew up because it was so militaristic. But I wonder if even that terror is many steps removed from what you grew up with that makes me in some ways less passionate, more distanced. I can sit back and think about thresholds and think about things because except those who went away to war, my family was never threatened. So I have much to think about now because I think the threat of it has scarred me in some ways. It made me fearful. And those are scars my children don't have. And I wonder whether we are telling them the truth about, I mean, there's a lot of nuclear weapons and capacities and on the threshold of capacity with those kind of weapons in many countries all over the globe. And this country is supplying the making of many of those weapons in one way or another. And yet I don't talk to my children about that. They don't crawl under their desks. They're afraid of earthquakes.
Well, it's... something to be scared of too. I see one major difference that comes from these different situations that I think is quite striking. I think that Americans in general think that war is a male thing. It's something that that men do. Which I think is different in Europe. In Europe, there is a much greater understanding that war affects all families and spouses, and not only soldiers, the question of the civilians. And then secondly, I think that it was very clear to me during the Gulf War that I experience in this country, that for many Americans, war is still a place where you can be a hero. And that might have to do with this idea of going away from home and fighting this noble fight and then coming back home to the family that I protected or something like that. I don't think that many Europeans would think that was a place for heroes, but rather that was a place for destruction, for tragedy, and for evil. And I think that has to do with the fact that that Europeans experienced war differently than Americans experienced war. Where war was something on the TV, something where you sent your men and then they would come back or they would not come back, but it would be much harder to relate to what really happened. And I know that many people I know who have been in Vietnam don't like to talk about it, don't speak about what really happened there, because it seemed to be so hard to relate for somebody who lives in this country, to really relate to what happens, what it is like to be in a war. I wanted to ask a question, if I may. The idea of this threshold and the really astonishing fact that nuclear weapons were never used in these past 50 years, although certainly there were empires collapsing that could have used nuclear weapons as their last bailout for the collapse or whatever. Do you think that that the experience of really the of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the awareness of people what horror and destruction nuclear weapons are capable of carrying out contributed to that? That it was experienced much more as a threshold, whereas in 1945 it was not experienced by the people who did it as that major threshold that they would cross.
Well, I think, yeah. And again, the film, I think, helped to document that the people that built the bombs weren't quite sure where they were going, and it was one of the remarkable things to me in watching the movie was to get that sense of drama of people who did not know what was going to come of this. And after the test, of course, the rolling on to using the bombs in warfare, but even then, with all of the firebombing that had gone on in Japan, it didn't seem like there'd been that much more destruction than the firebombs had caused. And when one measured those two bombs against the likely consequences of an attempt by the Americans to invade Japan, after all of the bloodshed in moving from island to island, one could use the utilitarian criteria, as you did when you talked about, you know, did it shorten the war? I mean, these are all utilitarian criteria. Were the bombs useful in shortening the war? Did they actually save more lives than they cost? Once we got past those two bombs and then developed the hydrogen bomb and saw the likely consequences of those bombs, it seems to me there was a much stronger tendency to say there's a threshold here. So in the time, it didn't seem like there was necessarily a huge threshold that we were crossing. But I think rather quickly, and as we saw in the history of Oppenheimer himself, we saw the development of a sense that this was truly a threshold to be reckoned with.
I wanted to ask Rick whether you think responsibility for a scientific project, progress, and the potential ramifications for that progress, whether responsibility for counting the cost and counting the benefit lies outside science, or whether science is capable of measuring those things itself. Is it a body of Christ imagery where you do one thing and I do another for you? Or are you, is science capable of questioning itself? There were in the movie some scientists apparently who gathered at Alamogordo and wondered, what is this for and should we go ahead? It seemed like a small group. What are the prospects for that kind of self-reflection within science as you've understood it?
I have a sense that they're better prospects because I think we have a stronger sense of the interconnectedness of things, an ecological sense, a holistic sense that's improving. Whether it's yet strong enough, I'm doubtful of that. And I think it certainly should be a responsibility of science and scientists. But not solely so.
One of the ways we've handled it in recent years with the Human Genome Project is that the grantors of the money for science to pursue its science have set aside a fixed percentage of that same money for others to study the ethical and theological ramifications. Is that a model for the future? Is that the way to go about it?
I think it's a ray of hope. I think it's clear that science big science is driven by something sometimes interests outside of itself. I think it becomes increasingly clear that science is not as objective and unbiased as we would be led to believe in early science classes, and that it is itself a product of societal and economic forces in response to those. And perhaps in the same way that science can't function without the resources financially, perhaps the moral deliberation needs some resources too.
One more follow-up. Can you think of a threshold that science has observed, a place where science has come up against a threshold and voluntarily stood down rather than pressing through? Anyone?
No, and I think that economic forces have a lot to do with it, and I think a ray of hope is a great way of describing the model that was described, because as Michael and I just spoke about the Apollo 13, with the original, the problem was something to do with the oxygen tank, and the problem was known, and then there was discussion, but it seems to be all right, and we have this 48-hour window, and then we're going to lose that, and we'll lose a whole month of work, and so on and so on, and NASA reputation. So I think economics has a lot to do with it, and causes a lot of trouble that affects scientists. And then, of course, there's also the ambition and the wanting to see your work completed, and you kind of tend to push aside moral questions because you get driven by the experiment. Who of us hasn't been driven by the end of a project, whatever it might be?
Well, it seems like in the Hiroshima situation, there was, you know, at the end of a 2-year or 4-year process, where $1 million or $1.8 billion had been spent, and all this energy had been brought together in one place. Is that is that something you could stop, or is that thing that just almost begins to generate its own energy? That must see itself through. But do we know whether science, I mean, do we have any example we can think of where science has voluntarily stood down and said, no matter how much we've spent, no matter how much human energy has been dedicated to the project, we won't go ahead?
It's kind of hard to do that as a scientist, because as a scientist, your basic question is not what should I do. You leave that to other people, but you want to know the how. And to detect a moral problem in the question how would leave only the alternative of ignorance. And that doesn't seem to be sound, to say, if I don't know, then I'm better off. And therefore, mm-hmm. I think this question cannot be posed to science. The question that science tries to answer is the how, and then the question of how we utilize the answers that science comes up with, that's another question, but you cannot blame science for the results of that.
John?
I wonder if we couldn't change the whole tack of this conversation. I was alive during the Second World War, and it seemed to me that the war on Hitler, not on the Germans, all these people get caught up, and we tend to call them brutes, but it was to stop a madman who was Hitler. And after the Second World War, the United Nations was set up in an attempt to stop wars. And yet, here we have things going on in Yugoslavia that are very similar. A damn fool of a of a person decides for whatever reason that he wants to create trouble, that that he wants finally to have his kind of Yugoslavia, and he's doing some of the same things as Hitler has done in his ethnic cleansing. And how could we have avoided that? How could we have avoided Hitler? And how can we now avoid similar situations? What are we doing in America about people that are going around bombing buildings? Are we prepared to deal with those people if, in fact, they're on some kind of track to try to become the rulers of this country and could possibly do some things that are really as fanatical as Hitler did? So I'm wondering, I would like to hear some conversation about avoiding what we can do to prevent wars.
Well, I think that here comes in what was said about the just war theory, that it might be unfortunate but naive to set the threshold that low, that killing, for example, would be already the threshold that I do not cross. Because that, in the case of Hitler, would have made quite clear that the international community would have watched Hitler or Saddam Hussein or whoever the madman is to do what they are inclined to do. The question that I would have in regard to Nagasaki and Hiroshima is, even if my goal is to stop and prevent more evil, applying directly the just war theory, does it allow me to use any means to reach that objective? Or do I put myself on the same level of these people when I use all the means that they use in order to accomplish their goal? And here I think the just war theory would clearly say no. If you would have a noble cause, but you use unjustifiable means, your war would not be just.
Unfortunately, I think when people get caught up in the war, I heard the veteran that was here the other night and his wife, and I experienced this great, great effort towards winning this war. People came together as they've never come together again in my lifetime. And when you're constantly painting people as devils, then those ideas of just war begin to blur, and they blur very quickly. And so again, my question is, how do we avoid getting into the situation? Because once it was necessary, I believe it was necessary to stop Hitler. Once we embark upon that path, then we're lost. And so we need desperately not to get involved in wars. And how do we do it when some powerful person begins to manipulate things, and it seems as if it takes, you know, Hitler never had a majority. He had a few thugs that were his people, and all the good people just cringed and gave up. I remember one person that was here this summer was just really amazed at how the Lutheran Church and all the people caved in, and the Catholics over in Germany, but yet when I asked them, well, what happened to you when the Desert Storm was going on, he quickly began to think about that, because there was a great deal of pressure brought on pastors at that time, and very few of them stood up.
Tim, I think there are at least two things that I see that offer a ray of hope in regard to possibilities. One is the tremendous insight that Gandhi has brought to us
that resonates with our gospel message and that was utilized by Martin Luther King and utilized in the United States civil rights movement. The possibility that we can do warfare not by killing the other, but by submitting ourselves to punishment, even corporal punishment. And the underlying assumption that there is something in the adversary eventually will be unwilling to continue to do the killing. However, in spite of all Gandhi's work, India still became independent in a bloodbath. Gandhi himself indicated he didn't know that he would use the same procedures for Hitler, the adversary, rather than the British. So we're not sure how much hope, but I think there's a ray of hope there, and it certainly resonates with the gospel message. A second hope is something that I think has really developed by leaps and bounds in the field of political science since I left the field. And that is that there is an extraordinary amount of new insight into negotiation. A whole field of negotiation has opened up. And, who among us would have thought it possible that the Berlin Wall would come down? Who among us would have thought it possible that we would see Israeli and Arab leaders come to the point that they have in the last years? I think that we are developing some new skills in negotiating, even in the toughest situations, with some new insights about how to resolve even some of the most basic conflicts. Neither of these gives us a lot of encouragement in the face of a madman. We still have to deal with the possibilities of Hitler-like leaders gaining enough power to be able to proceed as Saddam Hussein did. But it seems to me these offer rays of hope. And then, of course, I very much appreciated the sermon last night. As Christians, we are not without hope. The kingdom will come, and God will have the last word. That's our ultimate hope.
The problem, it seems to me, is that we have not sufficiently raised the question of the hierarchy of our loyalties as Christian people. I think that one of the great difficulties of the Lutheran Reformation and the Anglican Reformation, these two, is that both of them were instituted by civil authority. And for all Luther's brave words that it was God who was doing this and God who was doing that, it's very difficult to read the history of the 16th century without recognizing that. In fact, it was Frederick the Wise's enormously powerful position in the Roman Empire of that time, which made it possible for the reform of the evangelical territories to take place, or the reforms. I'm deeply concerned about the way in which Lutherans in Europe and in this country have not been able to establish the kind of hierarchy of loyalties which it seems to me is appropriate. If our highest loyalty is to the Christian gospel, if the greatest claim upon us is the Christian gospel, then that means that the civil authorities have a subordinate claim. And then the question is, how does one teach that? How do we inculcate that? How do we engage in the rituals of civil loyalty? I do not have any difficulty at all respecting the flag. I have enormous difficulty saluting it. I do not have any difficulty standing while the national anthem is played. I do not sing it. those are little ways in which I've tried to say, I respect the United States, I am glad to live here, I will do everything that I can for the well-being of this political community, but it is not, it does not have and will not ever have my highest loyalty. And the kinds of things, the symbolic kinds of things that I worry about are the fact that we supply chaplains to the military, that we have rarely been known to raise serious questions about American policies as a church, that we do not teach, and we're not really even prepared for something like the civil disobedience which Martin Luther King engaged in. Lutherans just don't do those kinds of things. We have equated our faith and our, that is, our faith in the gospel and our loyalty to our country as one and the same. I am deeply opposed to the Pro Deo et Patria award that the Boy Scouts give for Lutheran kids. We did not want our children to be scouts. There are all kinds of ways in which we tried, in our family at least, to say there's got to be a distinction between the gospel which has grasped you ultimately and the state which has a very subordinate claim on your loyalties. And it seems to me that until the mainstream churches are willing to do that, then we are in serious trouble. In this country, at least, the great struggle for Catholics and Lutherans and Jews, the three groups that Harold Bloom leaves outside of what he calls American religion, the great struggle all three of us had is to demonstrate how utterly loyal we are. In the First World War, editorials and Lutheran publications let no one doubt our patriotism. So Lutherans went out of their way then to begin to adopt the symbols of political loyalty, flags in our churches, gold star plaques in our narthexes for men who lost their lives in combat, bond drives and all kinds of other things that would demonstrate, you see, that a German-speaking denomination could be relied as we went to war against Germany, or that Catholics could be elected to high office and didn't have to worry about interference from a foreign power in Italy. I wish, in fact, that Catholicism pressed more the fact that its loyalties are larger than the country. And I don't know that Lutherans have the resources to be able to do that. But I think that's what's at stake. Otherwise, we are not going to be able to, just war is a piece of paper. We are not going to be able to raise the questions. I have to refer to Mike here. One of the things that I found most hopeful in the few months that I spent in East Germany, when it was East Germany, is the capacity of many Lutherans there to develop new ways of supporting a communist state, nevertheless distancing themselves from it and not giving their ultimate allegiance to that. I think that was the great lesson which Nazi Germany taught some of the people who were leaders in East Germany. But we have not had that experience in this country, and I think that's the primary problem.
Jim, and then Nikki, and then we'll see if we're ready to be done this evening.
Just a comment to piggyback on Tim's comment. You're talking about some things you've seen recently in political science emphasizing the importance of negotiation. I don't know if you're thinking of this volume, but there was one published by Oxford Press in 1994. The title was Religion, the Missing Dimension of Statecraft. And the thesis of the volume is political scientists and analysts have ignored religion over the last 30 years, primarily because religion has been seen as the root of so many social and political conflicts. But in the course of that accurate assessment, they've also neglected to notice that religion over the last 10 to 15 years has in fact worked in some places, not in all, but in some places to function as a catalyst for peace. And so the first and last chapters, or first two, three chapters, kind of articulate this thesis and lay out the basis for it. And then the middle chapters give you, you know, specific case studies, the Philippines, South Africa. How many of us imagined 10 years ago that South Africa would accomplish a peaceful democratic transition? Raise your hands. So, I mean, I didn't, and I lived there. I grew up there. I did not think it would happen. I thought it would come to blows. I thought blood would be shed. And it didn't. And one reason why it didn't was because of the role of South African council churches and other Christian and other religious organizations. Now, that doesn't mean, I mean, look at Bosnia. I mean, it's among other things, religion is an important driver there. But I think what it does show is that religion can be a powerful force for peacemaking. Jonathan today in this session was talking about how Christians might function as the bridge between Arabs and Jews in the Middle East. I think as members of religious communities, we have to take seriously this call to be peacemakers and to step up to the plate and try to figure out how to do that. It's not easy, and I'm not trying to pretend it is. I mean, the Philippines is a predominantly Christian country. South Africa is a predominantly Christian country, so maybe it was easier to accomplish things there. But there were 10 chapters in this book that, you know, articulate that. I'm not sure they were all predominantly Christian. So I just throw that out as another ray of hope or element of hope. And the fact that folks in the political science community have noticed that. I don't think about it.
I wonder what would happen if we as Christians would feel called to put our loyalties where we say they are and take the percentage of tax that pays for war not paid and give it to the poor. Just give it directly to the poor. It would be a sign of hope if more of us would do that, I think.
More the peace tax.
Yeah.
It's, I would like to react very briefly. I think that certainly there are a variety of ways to encourage one's own nation to promote peace rather than to promote war. I just read today in the New York Times that maybe good news for the Americans that the U.S. for the first time since decades is not the number one weapons exporter in the world, but France is now number one, and the U.S. dropped to number two.
Now we're the bomb number one.
That makes us feel better.
Good. But I think that that there are varieties of ways how to promote peace in communities by using the political possibilities that you have by using to make people more aware to support certain actions and others. So I don't think that would be only one way, but there are so many ways to do that I think that there's more reason to hope than most people think.
I think maybe we're back to some of these utilitarian criteria too. We did make it through 50 years without nuclear war, and it would be highly speculative to suggest that we might have made it through or might not have made it through had the United States declined
to utilize its nuclear capability, and the Soviets had been the only ones that it had. We may have bought ourselves 50 years of peace and a transition with the amount of money that we spent.
But Tim, think of how many wars we fought, or how many wars raged on the face of the planet, even though this nuclear, quote, umbrella sheltered us. I mean, there were an awful lot of wars. A lot of folks died in Vietnam. A lot of folks died in Central America. And that nuclear threshold held. You see what I'm saying? It didn't end war. It ended nuclear war. It prevented nuclear war. So it's a...
It didn't. You know, but I'm still saying the alternative to what we did may reasonably be argued to have been even worse. The alternative to not having military capability, not having had it over the last 50 years, may have been even worse than what we see happen over the last 50 years. It's debatable, but we're in that realm of taking an ethical question, answering it in terms of likely consequences, and then dealing with very imperfect information in the process of trying to make those judgments.
Jonathan, and then...
Yesterday I didn't sign up for the prayer vigil because I was hiking, but I had this thought beside Lyman Lake. Do you think we could have dropped the atomic bomb on Berlin? Or as, could we, as a white country, have used the atomic bomb on Germany? In terms of this threshold, too.
Did you see the day after Trinity? I think that was the whole move. I think that was the intent, was to use it against Germany.
Of course, that was the scientist's intent. We never did hear from, you know...
Right, the political intent, the public intent, you know, I mean...
I have no doubt in my mind that if the bomb would have been ready in the winter of 1945, then it would have been dropped in Germany.
I'm just overwhelmed by the sense of use because it was such a foreign place to us, people we didn't know very well, people we had prejudices about. It wasn't our own Lutheran, you know, enemies.
It's a speculative question, I guess, but
for other days.
Yes, Sonia?
Well, I was learned that the U.S. wanted to keep Germany as, not as destroyed as possible, as okay as possible to trade after the war with Germany, and so and because the U.S. wasn't as involved in the war as maybe England or France, they didn't have so much reason to revenge, and so they tried to. To have a partner for trade after war, not to destroy everything.
Well, I'd like to, I think it's time to draw this to a close unless someone has an absolutely irresistible thought to share. It's late and we've gone for an hour and a half easily. And to thank you for coming and thank the panelists for preparing.
I have an irresistible thought.
You have an irresistible urge to share it.